Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's lunch. My name is Enid Cho, correspondent governor of the FCC. Just a couple of reminders before we start. Please do turn off the sound of your phone and your other devices during the talk. And also do take a look at our website for our upcoming events. There are two that I'd like to mention quickly now. On the 28th, that's tomorrow, isn't it? Kevin Seitz is going to talk about a book he's written about combatants who in wars who've come back with moral injuries. It's called The Things They Cannot Say. And on June 3rd, Professor Michael DeGoye is going to present the findings of round three of his survey on constitutional reform in Hong Kong. So do look out for these. Today we have two co-authors of a new book called Cities Without Ground. They are both eminent architects, and they're going to share with us their view on Hong Kong's rather unique sort of urban landscape. Jonathan Solomon, on the right here, is an American architect and associate dean at the School of Architecture at Syracuse University. So Jonathan is going to kick off with sort of the formal bit of the presentation, and he's also got, as you can see, a few slides of old Hong Kong to show us. And then Adam Frampton, who's a practicing architect and a former associate at OMA, who's about to move to New York to start his own practice, he will join us in the Q&A section. So please put your hands together to welcome our two speakers today.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Enid. And I want to extend thanks on my and my co-author's behalf to the FCC and also to our publisher, Oro Editions, who are here in the audience for their help in organizing this presentation. It's very exciting to be here in Hong Kong presenting the result of really almost 3 years of effort, of research, writing, drawing, and ultimately publication of this book. The book is called A Hong Kong Guidebook, but it is not in a classic sense a guidebook. That is to say, I would not necessarily recommend it as a wayfinding device, although it could certainly be used as one. It's really intended more to be an exploration and a kind of explication of the unique urban logic and the kind of unique spatial forms that Hong Kong urbanism produces. I have a little bit of laryngitis, you can tell perhaps, so forgive me if I whisper a little bit into the microphone. I have here what is usually about a 50-minute presentation that I am extemporaneously reducing down to 20 minutes. So you'll forgive me if I speak a little bit from notes and a little bit not from notes. And Adam has promised to make some noise if I go over 25 minutes, although I don't expect it will be a problem. I'm speaking about Hong Kong to Hong Kongers, of course. So you all know the city's fantastic, remarkable history of growth from the 1960s onward, from scenes such as this, to scenes such as this, where we see the city, a city that never had any excess ground, growing not onto unused grounds, but creating new ground on which to grow, steep slopes or land reclaimed from the sea. Your image of Hong Kong, even if you live here today, is likely something like this. Skyscrapers packed densely together, set between verdant mountains and a very busy harbor. But in fact, we argue in Cities Without Ground that it is not the skyscraper that is Hong Kong's kind of most exceptional urban form, but rather the kind of thick mat of pedestrian circulation that takes place at the base of those skyscrapers, tying them together. We try to explore these interconnected lobbies, hotel lobbies, corporate lobbies, shopping malls, transit centers, et cetera, in cities without ground, and in doing so to kind of create a theory of Hong Kong's urbanism that can help better situate it. The city really is unlike any other city, even very dense ones. that struck me and my co-authors very early on in our time here. But we were particularly frustrated, I would say, at the kind of invisibility of its true order. Take very important sites in the city like this, the IFC complex under construction in 1998. You all know, of course, what a central urban node the IFC is, with multiple different pathways from many different transportation nodes, all converging in a. This, of course, is. Forgive me, I have only one pointer. This, of course, is where the IFC tower will go, and that ultimately becomes a kind of four-sided figure: the mall and the train station, through which people circulate from ferry piers. Bus terminals, train stations, etc., over footbridges to the city beyond. But we don't really have, as I said, we don't have a way of visualizing the way that network connects into other networks in the city. This is the Hong Kong guidebook, which you can buy at any 7-Eleven or Circle K. It's based on the famous A to Z map of London, which was famously compiled in the 1930s by an amateur, Phyllis Pearsall, who simply walked through the city of London taking notes and drawing. London and other ground-based cities can be understood in two dimensions by walking around streets, squares, intersections, etc. But Hong Kong, as evidenced, I think, clearly in conditions such as this, simply cannot. Its three-dimensionality precludes it. If this woman looks confused, it may be because north on this map is pointing down, but it's probably also, which doesn't help, it's probably also because she's trying to find her way from the central and mid-levels escalator where she is to the ferry piers here. And while this map, which is put up by the Central and Western District Council, does a fairly good job of illustrating the kind of global connectivity of the network of interconnected footbridges that bind the district together, leaves critical parts unmapped, such as the IFC, which appears as a kind of undifferentiated magenta blob at the bottom of the map. In fact, of course, the IFC does have an order, and a very clear one, and one that is mapped very precisely, in fact, by the mall itself. So again, you're probably aware that every shopping mall in Hong Kong, more or less, publishes its own little guidebook to itself, some of them quite sophisticated graphically. In the case of the IFC, we have a very nice, highly detailed representation of how a pedestrian might circulate around, what shops that pedestrian might encounter, where there might be footbridges or elevators or escalators. This map is limited because it doesn't show any connectivity. It doesn't show, for instance, that there's a train terminal, Hong Kong Station, below the kind of vertical plane of the drawing. Now, of course, the MTR also publishes maps to itself and does a fairly better job of explaining three-dimensional connectivity, largely through this technique of kind of stretching the map, the three-dimensional drawing a little bit so you can peer inside without breaking apart those escalators so you can still read the continuity. But we don't see that there is an enormous shopping mall and a corporate lobby and an international hotel over here, and we don't see that we can follow this path to Central Station and all of the various exits to the towers and other programs in Central. You are all Hong Kongers, but I'll still illustrate a little bit some of the issue here. So let's say we're arriving at this atrocious, outscaled, faux Edwardian mockery of the former central Star Ferry piers. We disembark, and the first thing we do is we cross this long footbridge erected by the Highways Department to bring us over the construction site of the new central waterfront. We then pass kind of briefly through the corner of the General Post Office and cross a footbridge into the IFC Mall, a kind of sanitized, global, generic, high-end shopping interior complete with perfumed air, highly reflective surfaces, private security guards, etc. Passing out of the IFC Mall, we again enter a kind of network of footbridges operated by the Highways Department, which, of course, if you are on a Sunday, you will find partially occupied by the city's foreign domestic worker population. We cross again a footbridge that is owned by the Highways Department but maintained by Hong Kong Land into a semi-open deck in Worldwide House that serves as a kind of impromptu food court, over another footbridge to a shopping mall branded by Emporio Armani, over another footbridge into the lobby of Alexandra House, corporate tower, over another footbridge into yet another generic global high-end shopping environment in Landmark Mall, over another footbridge into the Standard Chartered Bank building, over another footbridge and up what is essentially the ridge of a colonial era retaining wall battery path leading behind St. John's Cathedral to Cheung Kong Garden, which despite its kind of overall pleasantness and verdure is a complete fabrication. Those rocky outcroppings are concrete shaped to look like rock. It has artificial watercourses, etc., and is built over a parking garage. Our innovation in Cities Without Ground was simply to represent all of these spaces in the continuity in which they are actually experienced, undifferentiated by lines of ownership, differentiations between interior, exterior, differentiations between public and private, etc. We adopted the simple format of the stretched axonometric drawing, which we borrowed from the MTR. And then we set off for some fairly rigorous footwork. By limiting ourselves to drawing only those spaces that are accessible to pedestrians, we were able to conduct all of our research firsthand or by examining publicly available documentation, such as the shopping mall guides or exit path diagrams near elevator cores, etc. In the case of the IFC and, of course, Exchange Square, we see the mall now as, I'll try to do this without hitting Adam in the side of the face with my laser pointer. We see the mall as a kind of four-sided figure here at the heart of a nexus of pathways that connect transit spaces and other programs together. We also are able to observe a kind of fascinating and unique culture developing, which we try to illustrate by labeling the activities that we encountered over many years of passing through these spaces within or around them. So amateur musicians perform on the exterior footbridges while professional pianists are playing in the IFC Mall. Knockoff goods are being sold mere meters from boutiques that are carrying the real thing. Professionals, tourists, expat bankers, foreign domestic workers, local commuters, etc., all converge. In Cities Without Ground, we map 35 such sites throughout the city. In Mong Kok East, for example, a footbridge from Mong Kok Station leads here through Mong Kok East, the commuter rail station, to the I think it's the Grand Century Plaza Shopping Mall, the Royal Plaza Hotel, down two levels of escalators, over an elevated footbridge over Prince Edward's Road West, past a flower market, up onto an elevated park that serves as an impromptu bird market, before crossing yet another footbridge over Boundary Street, which of course is the historic border between Hong Kong and the territory of Hong Kong and Qing Dynasty China before the acquisition of the new territories. In Lam Tin, suburban transit hub built over the expressway, below Sinway Gardens here, is connected to older housing estates on the hill through eight stories of escalators and two private shopping malls, Sinway Plaza and the Kai Tin shopping center. You can also, of course, make the journey on 122 steps outdoors. And when we visited, there was one lone granny slowly walking up those steps. Hong Kong is neither the result of comprehensive top-down planning, nor is it the result of purely bottom-up informal solution finding. This image, this is of the old, this is the old post office on Connaught Road and, Petter Street, torn down in the 1970s, shown just as the sort of surrounding footbridges are starting to penetrate it. And we think this image illustrates very nicely some of the ways in which those two forces, the top-down planning and the kind of bottom-up solution finding in the city, collaborate to produce a very unique urban form. Let me give this footbridge as an example. This is Chatter Road in 1965. The bridge is joining Prince's Building with the Mandarin Hotel, and two properties both owned by Hong Kong Land. It's hard to, and of course in the distance there, sorry, you can see the old Hong Kong Club through here, which was torn down and replaced by a lovely Harry Seidler skyscraper. It's hard to see this bridge as anything other than a kind of opportunistic attempt to maximize profits for the developer, right? It's a kind of a one-off. Even though, of course, the elevated deck, if there are any architects or planners in the room, elevated decks have a kind of modernist pedigree. Figures like Colin Buchanan and his book Traffic in Towns had significant influence on Hong Kong planners at the time. This bridge, it's hard to see this bridge as part of any larger plan. It's simply an attempt by the developer to bring the wealthy tourists directly into the elevated shopping deck and maximize profits. However, the technique, the network proves valuable. It proves to work. In other words, the developer can lease that elevated space at rents that are as high as, if not higher, than their ground floor spaces. And people start to realize they can commute more easily. They don't have to wait for traffic lights. They can kind of move through buildings as more and more are connected on a kind of bit-by-bit basis. And by the early 1980s, the Hong Kong government says, well, hey, this is a great idea. We should get involved as well. And it's hard to see this network of footbridges, which is erected by the Highways Department, this is Connaught Road in 1982, as anything other than a top-down attempt by the Hong Kong government to ease the movement of commuters from ferry piers on one side of the newly expanded roadway to the city on the other. But the resulting complex, as I suggested earlier, falls into neither of these top-down or bottom-up categories. Highways Department owns the bridges, private developers maintain many of them, and of course own the lobbies and shopping malls that they intersect. If either party shuts their portions down, the system ceases to function. The network is neither the product of abstract ideas nor the result of top-down planning or of kind of purely self-organizing systems. It's some new and combined thing. How much more time do I have? How am I doing? I've lost count. All right, let me go on to talk about two other examples of this phenomena, and then maybe we can take some questions and have some discussion. And I'll direct you, of course, to the book, which I believe there are some copies of here, for some more detail on some more buildings that we found exemplary of some of these conditions in the city. Let me suggest quickly two more examples of the kind of unique urbanism of Hong Kong. One, of course, is the central and mid-levels escalator, envisaged by the Highways Department as a kind of traffic reliever, as a way of reducing the traffic on roads. It, of course, had unexpected effects after its construction. It's shown here shortly after it opened in 1994. The escalator Of course, by making the hillside of what had been a kind of sleepy neighborhood behind Central more accessible, transformed it into a premier entertainment district and brought new congestion, actually increasing pedestrian traffic, and of course, raising land values. There are now a series of escalators being considered in the territory, many of them on the west side of Hong Kong Island, several of them already constructed. I was just on Center Streets the other day. The conversation now around these escalators is not a top-down conversation of the government seeking to mitigate traffic, but a bottom-up conversation of local districts who either landowners generally, developers who want to see the gentrifying effects of the central and mid-levels escalator, and again, generally local residents who feel that they're threatened by those same effects and who don't want to see that kind of gentrification. Secondly, and perhaps a less well-known example, a favorite of mine, are the express escalators in Times Square over in Causeway Bay. Many of you remember, perhaps, that Times Square used to be an atrium mall built on the North American model, a 9-story high atrium with a kind of switchback escalator system that circulated you past as many shops as possible. This, in Hong Kong's kind of hyper shopping environment, proved ineffective, insufficient to move people up to the higher levels in the food court, etc. So that void, that kind of emptiness, got filled by these sort of skip-stop express escalators, which spiral up from the ground floor and allow you to kind of hop from one to the other, shaving, nearly 120 seconds off of that journey, but apparently worth the tremendous expense of bringing them in. The express escalators, I liken them to kind of paths that get tread on a campus quad in the grass when students cut the kind of shortcut from one door to another, which generally wear down the lawn, and then the college will come in and see this and they'll pave them over and create a path. Similarly, there was clearly a line of desire. Hong Kongers desired to move faster, informally up to the top of the shopping mall, and that line got formalized by this, by the imposition of the express escalators. This is a kind of an example in microcosm of what occurs at a larger scale in the city. We have a little more material in the book, and we look specifically at some Hong Kong buildings. I think I'll just mention them by name here and then wrap up. One of them is Shun Tak Center, all buildings from the early 1980s, more or less, that fall out of the city's mainstream architectural narrative, but are nonetheless exceptional. One is Shun Tak Center in Sheung Wan, on the site of the Macau Ferry, a building which wonderfully illustrates the lack of a kind of stable ground in the city, but the kind of hyper-connectivity between transit modes that the city espouses. The other is Queensway Plaza, recently renovated shopping mall built over the Admiralty train station. A peculiar building form, a kind of windowless, solid, one-story podium without a tower, dropped in the middle of what should be a void between six buildings built on top of the MTR station. And then finally, the Lockhart Road Municipal Services Building, early example of the kind of combined wet market and community center in Hong Kong neighborhoods. We try to conclude the book with a statement about space and politics in the city, and I wanted to show this image before wrapping up. This, of course, is Occupy Hong Kong, which until September of last year, for nearly a year, was encamped in the space under the HSBC main building. Of course, in New York, in Zuccotti Park, the Occupy Wall Street movement was in the space adjacent to global capital. In Hong Kong, the Occupy movement was literally under the space of global capital, or within the space of global capital. The very week that this encampment was cleared, protests against the imposition of national education in secondary school curricula occupied the footbridges surrounding the new government headquarters at Tamar. This and other moments in the city in which the kind of residual spaces, the shopping malls, the the atria, the footbridges of the city get occupied, not just for mundane activities, kind of quotidian activities, but for political activities, demonstrates the viability in Hong Kong of this network as a public space, or a space of public occupation. So with that, I'll wrap up and we'll have some time for conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan.
You're welcome. You know what, I'm actually gonna go back to that view rather than reveal my my notes. All right. Great.
If you want to, join us here, and I'll turn your mics on. That's it. Let's start a Q&A. I can see a hand there, Edith. Can she have the mic, please?
This is more of a suggestion than a question. When I first arrived in Hong Kong, one of my colleagues showed me how to navigate the walkways and reduce a trip of about, I don't know, probably hours getting across from Central to Admiralty to a few minutes. Now, the suggestion is that you quickly patent an app on this with GPS navigation tools for people to get around the city, and not just the central part, but these outlying, the new towns and other areas that you've also so kindly mapped for us.
Is that doable, gentlemen?
I'll bring that up with my publisher.
Thank you. Next question. I saw that hand first. Gentleman at the back, please.
John Hung, 5216. First of all, I'd like to say that I was in the company that operated Times Square. And one of the reasons why those travel agents are bypassing floors is, on my own admittance, a short provision of lifts originally. So really, you couldn't get people up and down in time, and you couldn't add more lifts at that time. But in fact, if you look at Times Square today, there are more lifts. Some cargo lifts have been turned into big, big lifts. And these things arose out of absolute necessity, really. That's a clarification for you. The other thing which I really wanted to ask is that I know it seems to be outside the scope of what you talked about today, but to us who are living here, and I've been a long-term resident here, of what we call this world city of ours, it seems to be totally devoid of open space in terms of green grass, lawn areas. I lived in Singapore for about 14 years, I was at the time in the early 1990s, I was chairman of the Sports Development Board here, and I found that we had, at that time, it might be updated now, we had 43 green fields dedicated to sports, shared between 7 million people. And at the same time, in the early 90s, there are, I believe, in excess of 300 sports grounds shared among 4 million people in Singapore. And, and here it seems that maybe my view is different. Every time we turn a private piece of ground into public use, like Cheddar Gardens, we turn it into concrete. Now, to me, in every world city, you've got to have a park in the middle of a city. Central Park, Bois de Boulogne, Hyde Park, wherever you go, there is one. Hong Kong, it seems to be nowhere for office workers to run their docks around, have a sandwich over lunch, and so on and so forth. Is there something which, in your opinion, as space architects, planners, a need for green fields in major cities that's accessible to not just the rich and the wealthy, but to everybody? I was actually very much a part of the Hong Kong Cricket Club, and the government took it back and say it's got to be dedicated for public use because we can't have a big ground right next to the China Bank building to the use of only 400 members playing stupid game of cricket, British sport, you know. So we eventually lost and gave back to the government. What I see there is not very good use of a beautiful piece of lawn which looked right in the dead center of the city Now it's all hidden and concreted. It seemed to be a gathering ground for protest. I'd just like a comment on that, on the general usage, without going into this urban stuff, which I'm very impressed
with. Adam, would you like to go first?
Sure. Well, thank you for your comment. I think we also agree that Hong Kong needs kind of higher quality public space, that it needs cleaner air, that it can use more trees. Although, on the other hand, if you consider the kind of cumulative land of Hong Kong, it's in fact 70% park, I believe. And so the city itself, I think, is, for me, what's extremely exceptional about Hong Kong is this kind of extreme juxtaposition of kind of sort of city and nature. And I think that in a way, or maybe to kind of take, for instance, the West Kowloon, the planning of the West Kowloon Cultural District, Norman Foster's winning scheme is the kind of primary arguments about the design are based on the 10,000 trees which are planned there. And now I think it's down to 5,000 or 6,000 trees. The number has been kind of increasingly cut down. But in a way, I think the kind of outcome of our studies, of our book, is that in fact kind of the three-dimensional connectivity of it will be a bigger factor in whether the space is sort of successful or not in the future.
I would only add to that by saying, in reference to your first point, it's good to hear. I'm interested to know more about the origin of the express escalators. I've noticed some of them in, I guess it's World Trade Center as well, under the hotel. but I think Hong Kong has an obsession with connectivity. And our book was, and the express escalators are an expression of that obsession. Shuntak Center or Queensway Plaza are great early examples of the obsession of that connectivity. Our book is an illustration of the results of, 20 or 30 years of construction based on that obsession. And our discovery, I would say, is that given the lack of public open space, these kind of connective tissues in Hong Kong serve the city as a substitute to public space and should be understood as a public space. In other words, Highways Department's utter resistance to considering a footbridge to be a space where one could put a bench and where people might sit, I think is something that we would hope to change with our book. That we could illustrate that there is more, there's more potential than they're actually enacting. That being said, Adam and I led a little walking tour yesterday that ended at the Tamar site, the central government offices. I have plenty to say about what's good or bad about that building. I also took a tour myself of the inside of the building, so no comment at all on the workmanship. But the podium design there, I think, is doing some things really, really well. I think the idea of bringing the lawn down to the waterfront, of creating softer pedestrian connections with the waterfront, of mitigating to some degree the effects of that terrible road going along the water. The intentions, at least of the architect, to network it back into the city, which are remarkably sort of foiled in this spectacular fashion by the MTR Corporation when that bridge hits, stops centimeters short of hitting Admiralty Center and then forces you to kind of circulate down and around, to get in. So, I, at least, as a resident of Hong Kong for 6 years, have a kind of advanced love-hate relationship with the city's connectivity and its strange approaches to public space. But I don't disagree with you that the city needs more green space and more open space. But I do suggest that what we do have is in itself valuable and interesting.
Next question.
I see.
Paul Zimmerman, the Cities with Our Ground seems to celebrate somewhat our elevated connectivity. But I think that we can also see, we can see good things of it. People are willing to make detours and being forced to make elevation changes when it rains. But otherwise, we all like to be on the land that God has created, which is our real ground. I mean, Cities with Our Ground suggest we have no ground, but I believe that the rain finds the ground and God has created the ground and all people know where the ground is. It's our most public space. And isn't that the celebration of it? You could maybe just talk a little bit about the downsides, the privatization of public space, the forced detours, the forced elevation changes, and the excuse of that it provides the highways department to completely annihilate ground level.
Jonathan promised to deflect all the hard questions to me, so
specifically Paul's questions. But I'll take it on. I can take it on if you like. I'll take it on very quickly, Paul, because of course we've had a longer discussion about these issues. But I've never heard anyone, and I certainly wouldn't have expected you, Paul, to confuse the Hong Kong government with God. You suggest that we want to be on the ground that God has created. In Central, of course, we're on the ground that the Hong Kong government has created over many, many years of reclaiming land from the sea. Hong Kong is in its entirety, mostly. I mean, I should be careful because there are not the entire city is not Central, and the entire city is not even Sha Tin. But Hong Kong, by and large, is a construct. It's a kind of manufactured ground, and I'm certainly prepared to have a discussion about making that constructed ground as pleasant as it can be and as functional as it can be, and I am as aghast as anybody at being penned up like cattle when I try to move around on the street in Central. I think it's terrible, but I also think that the footbridges are worth celebrating. So, with that, I will deflect the comment to Adam for further comment.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons why the book is called Without Grounds is indeed because we looked at the situation in Hong Kong and then we compared it to kind of other cities like New York or Tokyo or Minneapolis, where they have both kind of above ground and sort of underground, very extensive kind of pedestrian networks. And what we found that was sort of unique in Hong Kong is that really there is no more reference to this kind of stable datum of the ground. And in fact, you have kind of connections above, you have connections below, you have cases where, for instance, a footbridge sort of turns into a tunnel. And in a way, it's actually the kind of quality and the experience of the spaces is really ambiguous, or is really not linked to whether they're happening on the ground plane. So I think in many Western cities, for instance, New York, you could say that what happens on the ground plane is kind of clearly better than what is happening from a retail perspective, from a kind of public perspective, from kind of experiential perspective than what's happening kind of several levels up. In Hong Kong, I think that's really not the case, and we can create, if we consider them kind of all equal, we can then start to imagine that they are all sort of have as a kind of a public dimension, etc.
From the real estate operator's point of view, the reason why the connectivity is there is because of the back of the mind feeling that you will earn the most if you try to make every floor a ground floor. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So you've got this multi-story thing. I could tell you a story in Chun Wan many, many years ago. The Wharf Group built a 14-story building that lifted containers to every level. So you've got the door-to-door idea. So
that gentleman over there.
Do you see the possibility that in the coming years, a substantial amount of Hong Kong's underground space will be developed for urban development, like, or even maybe the earth beneath the hill that makes the peak? You know?
Yes, the whole rock cavern conversation. I mean, this is not my expertise. Can you put a waste treatment facility in a rock cavern or other large infrastructural thing? To the extent that those things can be done, I expect they will be. You certainly easier, politically easier to put a lot of the city's larger, more offensive infrastructural programs deep in a hillside. It's incredibly expensive to burrow into solid rock. And most of the land works that get done on hillsides, for instance, are done by cut and fill. which is comparatively easy. You kind of scrape some land off and you push it to the side and you create a little flat space, and that's kind of terracing. That's how the entire, you know, Victoria Peak is occupied. So I know as an amateur that at the infrastructural scale that's being studied, but I see it as a slightly different phenomenon than this. Am I free to call on people?
Thanks for your presentation. Did you give any thought to the sort of informal rules of the road that develop on these human highways? I mean, you know, people tend to keep right, but people also walk five abreast really slowly in a way that would never be allowed on a real highway. And that was one question. The other one was air conditioning and humidity. Obviously, a lot of these walkways aren't air conditioned, but I feel like if you stay at that level, you spend more of your time in an air-conditioned environment than otherwise. And I wondered if that was important.
I'm going to jump to air conditioning slides while Adam answers.
Yeah, actually, what you sort of brought up about atmosphere, I think, is a really interesting point and a kind of dimension to our book as well, because we sort of saw that if you have a figure such as this, it in fact kind of lacks the sort of legibility and kind of hierarchy that you have in a traditional city. So there's really no center, there's no edge, there's no nodes. And what happens instead is that
this is central, by the way.
The spaces are kind of ordered, let's say, instead by indeed kind of temperature, humidity, the kind of the use or the program that happens there often relates to what to whether they're kind of heavily air conditioned or sheltered or kind of adjacent emissions of sound and noise and this kind of thing. And I think that, for instance, the one fascinating case really is the HSBC lobby, which is of course taken very heavily used and taken over. We speculated, among other things, because of the sort of downdraft of air conditioning kind of coming out of that atrium that creates a very pleasant sort of semi-conditioned indoor-outdoor space, and that may be why in fact, all these people are here in this space. So.
Only if there's restrictions.
We have time for two more questions, so that gentleman first, and then.
Alex McMillan. I guess I have quite a simple question, which is, do you think that this kind of connectivity or the way that Hong Kong has ended up being designed is good? Is it a good thing? And then secondly, do you think that other cities will sort of follow suit later and we're just ahead, or is Hong Kong just unusual?
Go for it.
I can take it, yeah.
Go for it.
That's a question also that we seem to get actually every time that we present the book, actually. And I think that our goal is actually not to... although our maps are not that objective, we do claim to be kind of objective sort of mappers of these networks, and I think we're less interested in as a whole whether it's kind of good or bad, as what are the good components of it and what are the kind of bad components of it. And our exercise or our project, I think, demonstrates where the kind of connections or the spaces are extremely efficient and kind of interesting, or perhaps very inefficient, and therefore also kind of to accommodate sort of more activity or more. Well, I think it's not, in a way, if you step back to the assumption that in Hong Kong we live in a certain amount of density where that enables kind of 90% of people to take public transportation to work, the Cities Without Ground is simply a kind of outcome of that, and it's in fact the only way to make that work. So we could have a kind of city that looks like many others in the world, and it could perhaps have more parks and trees and wide boulevards, but everyone would also have to therefore drive to work, perhaps.
The reason the good question is hard, I think, for us particularly, is that it suggests a kind of moral reading, you know, to the city. And if good is a city with ground, and whatever that means, a city with tree-lined streets where the cars move slowly and the pedestrians are
quiet and the air is clean, then there perhaps there are things to critique Hong Kong about. If good is a city that is convenient and occupied and lively and well used and many other things, then perhaps there are things to learn from Hong Kong. So I am willing to, and I think we all three of us are willing to say that we think this system overall is good, that there are good things that relate to it. Certainly there are bad footbridges within that network. There are ones that I would want to change. There are areas that are either designed or have grown accidentally into better or worse conditions. But I try to avoid bringing, for instance, a kind of a Western notion of what a good city is and kind of laminating that on top of a city that's grown under such unique circumstances, such as Hong Kong, that it may have its own system of value in terms of judgment of what is good. I would prefer to be quieter in the city of Hong Kong, but its liveliness is its own quality. It's not bad.
And I think maybe one, not to moralize more, but to answer the second part of your question also, I think it is being seen as a kind of template for other cities. And the kind of three conditions that we identify that create this, which are topography, climate, and density, I think if we see in other cities in the world, perhaps undergoing densification or climate change, if we see sort of two out of three of these factors, we can... perhaps kind of similar systems will emerge sort of elsewhere. I don't think that it can be in mainland China now. I think Hong Kong is seen really as a kind of model to be kind of exported to for cities literally to kind of copy Hong Kong, but obviously that can't happen. It has to be, it's so specific to here that again, it's kind of hard to, I think why we can say it's good is because it is being actually considered sort of elsewhere, let's say. So.
Okay, Vodine, would you like to ask the last question?
It's historical. You've talked about some of the early footbridges and so on, and how there were both top-down and bottom-up approaches and how it's created its own beautiful chaos. Mm. But which was the first and why? Was it a private initiative? Was it a government initiative? Exactly, historically, where would you place it?
Careful, because there may be an actual historian in the room who can correct me.
I'm researching Hong Kong land.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, it's my understanding that the Chatter Road footbridge was the first private interior bridge linking two private properties over a public street. There is an earlier footbridge, literally an extra stairs that lead up to an open deck that crosses a street in Causeway Bay from 61, I think. But I can look up the reference where I found that for you. But I'm willing to be corrected. I think that's the first pedestrian walkway. But that was a highways department bridge. It didn't link to properties. It simply got you across the street. Right. You're welcome.
Great. I'm afraid we've run out of time. As Jonathan mentioned, this. There are quite a few copies of Cities Without Ground for sale just out there, which they will both be very happy to sign for you. So please join me in thanking our two wonderful speakers today, and hope to see you again soon.